You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Till you wake up on your own, I wonder where you are and live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so why don't you smile?
I don't know, maybe about a week ago, maybe longer, I met a guy named Neil through a woman by the name of Jennifer. Neil then called me and said, I want you to meet Patricia. I've given her your contact information. I hope she calls you, but I'm not sure that she will. And then, lo and behold, I get a phone call. Don't recognize the number. And I say hello. And joining us is Patricia Conger. Patricia, first of all, thanks for calling that day. And thanks for coming on All Marine Radio and doing this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, first of all, let's talk about you. So before we can talk about anything else, we got to talk about you to find out if we can believe you or not, because as Marines, we're always skeptical of everybody. So first of all, born and raised where?
So we were born, I have a twin brother, so we were born in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Ah.
And my dad was a Marine, but he got out of the service and moved there after his enlistment and met my mother and got married and then had us. Then we moved to Provo area until we were three because my dad went to school there at BYU. And then we moved to the Bay Area until we were 10 or 11. And then we moved to northern Utah, to Ogden, Utah, where the Golden Spike was driven in for the railroad.
Well, this is for people for East Coast people, you're like, this is like West Coast stuff, so everybody knows. So
yeah.
Snoop Dogg and everybody is good with this, but the Bay Area, for those of you who don't know, it's the San Francisco Bay Area. And and the Golden Spike, for all you people who did not pay attention in history, is do you want to, I mean, since you're from there, do you want to give them like 60 seconds of the Golden Spike story?
Yeah, so the both coasts had rail crews building the railroad all the way across the continental U.S. And as I remember the story, learning it in third grade, is the white guys were on the West Coast going east. And all the Asian guys were on the East Coast going west. And they met in Utah.
Hold on. The Chinese guys were in San Francisco going east, right?
No.
Yes.
As I remember, it was the Asian guys that were kicking butt and going.
Okay, I think you got that. I think you got that wrong. As somebody who's been to the Railroad Museum in Sacramento, and if you've never been there, you need to go there, Patricia. But I think it was the Chinese out of San Francisco. And then it was we Irish, don't you know, that were building it from east to the west. But
well, I could definitely be wrong.
All right,
I've been wrong before, and I'm basing it on third grade history here. I haven't heard the story or even thought about it.
Well, I went to the museum about a year ago, and I'm going to tell you that. What's amazing is when you go. I mean, the big deal was, you know, on the West Coast was getting the railroad over the Sierra Nevadas. They could not figure out how to do that, and they knew that
they had to do a lot of blasting.
Oh my God! And they knew that whoever owned that was going to make a lot of money. And so there was a lot of people that were very interested, and it was Chinese labor that went up in the Sierras and blasted those railroad beds into the side of mountains. and all of that over, and it's really fascinating stuff. The way they did it, the science behind it, and then all the money that guys like Stanford, Huntington, Crocker, and there's one more guy I can't remember. But it's Sacramento has a really cool museum, and a lot of it devoted to exactly that, going the Southern Pacific, going over the Sierra Nevadas, and all the money that was to be made there. But
yeah,
that's beside the point. We're talking about the Golden Spike in what, Promontory, Utah?
Promontory Point, Utah. Yeah, and yeah, that's where the Golden Spike was driven in. I think they just had. They just had a big to-do a couple summers ago about it, and I don't remember the number of anniversaries it was, but it's a, yeah, the little town of Ogden that we live in, or that we were living in, that we went to high school in, was a railroad town. It was, you know, not like the rest of Utah, so.
It wasn't? Like, what do you mean?
It was not settled by, it was mostly Mormon pioneers. It was railroad workers.
Oh.
So it was a little different. They have like, during Prohibition, there's a bunch of tunnels under the town where they smuggled everything, and just different than the rest of Utah.
Like good Judeo-Christian people would do. The just on an aside, Prohibition fascinates me. How did the whole country decide that it was a bad thing to drink? And if you go back and you watch, Ken Burns has an incredible documentary about it. I mean, the whole country concluded that alcohol was bad, and that's how the amendment got passed. So it's incredible to think that the whole nation would come down like that, but it did.
And, like, what were the politics behind it? Yeah,
right?
How could, because you can't get anything passed today for
for anything.
Can agree on anything, but this, the whole country agreed on this.
On that, we're not going to drink anymore. It's over, right?
Yeah.
And so
how long has people been working on getting marijuana legal?
Right.
I mean, it just,
or the equal rights amendment still isn't passed. Right. And so, you know, it still hasn't become a constitutional amendment. But again, to tell the story. So the Golden Spike is the actual spike that was driven, right? When they this was a big ceremony where they pounded it in the ground, and the eastern and western coast of the United States were connected.
Yep. Yeah.
There you go. A little bit of Western history for all you knuckleheads out there. You could say you're welcome. You could send me an email and say you're welcome. It was a big deal. And I remember the centennial of that when I was a kid or sometime, a teenager or something, because it was a big deal. They reenacted the ceremony, and, you know, it was the linking of transcontinental United States. And now you could go from New York City to San Francisco in, I don't know, 5-6 days or something like that, chugging through the United States. So,
yeah.
Well, of all the places you grew up, did you have a favorite?
Well, I have to say Bay Area all the time, because that's the place that my parents ripped me away from, and I never got a chance to fully come to hate that town, you know, as teenagers. I think teenagers have to hate the town that they grow up in as teenagers. But our family they all live in California. And so it's always just kind of been our town. And when my now ex-husband joined the Marine Corps, He did his MOS in 29 Palms, and I went with him there. And then he got stationed in Camp Pendleton, and then we got divorced, and I ended up living there for 13 years before I just barely moved back to Northern Utah last summer.
Living in Southern California for 13 years?
Yeah.
Wow. Whereabouts in Southern California?
San Diego.
Yeah. No, it's one of America's finest city. I went to college there, University of San Diego, up there on the hill.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. The so what do you have Marines all through your life there?
Yep. My dad is a Marine, and my twin brother is a Marine, and my ex-husband is still an active duty Marine.
Wow. So what's the best part of having Marines in your family?
You know, when I was in kindergarten, I remember, like, they were asking if anyone, they had, like, Veterans Day, and they were asking if anyone had any service members in their family, and everyone's like, oh, my dad's in the Army, oh, my dad's in the Navy, and every kid was like, Army, Navy, Army, Navy, and I was like, oh, my dad's the only one in the Marines. The Marines, that's, I'm so embarrassed. I'm the only one, you know, and I raised my hand in kindergarten. I said, Marines. And all the parents that were in the room, like all the service members were like, oh, Marine Corps. Like they just instantly like got silent and they're like, yeah.
That's the cool patrol. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. They're like, oh, the Marine Corps. Yeah. And so I was like, oh, what is this? So even in kindergarten, I was like, oh, okay. So not a lot of people in the Marine Corps, but boy, people really had a little bit more respect for it.
And they know. The few, the proud, even they know.
Yeah. Yep.
How funny is that? So now you have a family, right? So what do you do for a living, Patricia?
I'm a solar electrical designer.
Whoa, what does that mean?
So solar is really big, and is residential solar and commercial solar is really big, especially in Southern California.
Right.
And so I draw the plans for companies or for people who there's owner builders that want to put solar on their own houses. And then there's companies that need plans. And I draw the plans for the permits. It's not a lot of people think, oh, so you figure out where to put the modules on the roof. And that's the only thing I don't do. I do all the electrical design and I make sure that whoever puts the modules on your roof doesn't burn your house down.
Yeah, so, nobody likes that. Nobody's a fan.
Yeah.
Nobody's a fan of that. How's so tell me about solar. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? If you were going to give advice about solar, what would it be?
Go solar as soon as possible. It will save you so much money. Some people say, "Oh, well, I'll wait until they're smaller." They're not ever going to get smaller. They're just getting bigger. They're getting more powerful, they're getting more efficient. Always, always, always just go solar. Shop around. Make sure that you got a good contractor that is going to do good work, because I've seen some terrible work. And make sure that you talk to at least 5 contractors. I always say talk to 5 contractors. And if you want to do it yourself, if you're a do-it-yourselfer type person, don't be afraid. You can do it. Women, get up there on that roof and do that, because
you can do it.
Do it. Anyone can do it.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Before we get to you, you can do it yourself, solar?
Yeah, you can. I sell kits, too, on the side.
Really? So women, you can do it, too? Did you put solar power in your house?
So I don't own a home right now.
Right.
I actually moved to Utah so that I could buy a home.
Right.
But I was sidetracked a little there.
Right.
But I was, yeah, when I've installed tons and tons of solar. I've done ground mounts. I haven't installed any commercial solar myself. I've designed it, but I've never installed it. But yeah, I've done ground mounts and I've done roof mount solar. I've installed it. I've designed it. I've done sales. I've done bids. I've done permits. I've everything that's in solar that you could possibly do except for payroll, I've done.
So, wow. Now, hey, let me tell you, when a girl says get up there and do solar, then I don't know that there's any questions you ask after that. So if you're a do-it-yourselfer, it's possible. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. There's no moving parts. It's it's really just kind of plug and play. It's so easy. I'm putting together like videos and photos. I always take pictures of every project I've ever installed or been on. And it really is extremely easy.
Do you have a business?
No.
Okay.
I just moved to Utah, so right. I haven't like started my official business in Utah yet, but okay. I do still like people know me. And so they'll call me for plans or they'll call me for kits. I have a lot of small contractors that when you're a small, if you buy a lot of stuff, you get bigger and bigger discounts. So it's cheaper for them to buy it from me than to go to CED or any of the other distributors themselves. So they buy kits from me rather than go directly. Because if they're selling on the side or if they're installing on the side, then they don't have the relationships and everything built up that I do. So they'll call me and I'll just run it through and get them a kit and send it out to them.
There you have it. All right, so we know who to call when we need solar advice. Or what do I do now, Patricia? I just screwed it up. So Patricia, now let's talk about your twin brother. So tell us about what's it like to be a twin. I'm not a twin. What's it like to be one?
So it's interesting because I always used to just think, oh, well, it's just like being any other kind of brother and sister. We're not identical. So it's not the same. I always just thought it's like being any other type of brother and sister. But looking back over the years, and I was actually looking back over the years before everything happened with Jesse. When I moved to Utah, when I told my parents, hey, I'm going to move to Utah so I can buy a house, I told them, I think at the end of February, and my dad said, oh, your brother is moving here next week. And I said, what? Jesse's moving to Utah? And he said, yeah, he's going to build a house. And I was like, it just blew me away because we've both been away from Utah for so long. He's been away a lot longer than me and traveled a lot further and further, further and far more wide than I have. But I just thought, that's interesting. And I thought, it's like we're both being called home. And I wondered if we were being called home. And I thought, because I had been questioning. I'd been like, oh, should I leave I had a really great job in San Diego. Should I, you know, pull my kids out of their schools? And their dad lives in San Diego. He's stationed at Miramar. And I was just like, should I move? Should I not? And I was really questioning. But as soon as my dad said that Jesse had also moved to Utah or was moving to Utah, I thought, yes, I have to move to Utah. I know that now I know I have to move to Utah.
That twin thing that we always hear about.
Yeah. And so we have, you know, we got married. He got married later than me. He got married about a year after I did. But, you know, we got married, started having kids about the same time. Our kids are both we each have two kids. Opposite, my oldest is a boy and his is a girl. And then our youngest mine's a girl and his is a boy. And we've had our kids are both about the same ages as each other. And then, he got divorced, just about a year after I did as well. And then we both got remarried at about the same time. And then again, divorced at about the same time. And then, we were going to end up moving to Utah at about the same time. And it's these major, so I don't say, it's not like we're connected like twins where we read each other's minds, but I do feel like our lives are extremely parallel. And at first I used to think, oh, that's just because you know, we're the same age and we're going to go through, we're going to, you know, get married, you know, and just do these things at about the same time just because of our age. But as soon as my dad said, Jesse's moving here next week, I was like, I know that we're, I just felt very strongly. Like I said, I was being called back to Utah and I didn't know why, but I felt like it was absolutely what I needed to do.
All right. Now, just so everybody knows, Jesse got out of the Marine Corps, and Jesse's been missing since when?
Jesse went missing August 14th,
2019. And then his car was found in December?
January 23rd of 2020.
January 23rd of 2020. And so we want to talk about that. So Patricia and I were talking the other day, and I said, hey, would you come on and kind of tell the story and update it and tell us where you're at with it. And that way anybody who can help obviously can reach out and whatnot. So talk to us about Jesse. He joins the Marine Corps. How long is he in the Marine Corps?
He was in for 10 years, from 04 to 14.
Wow. And what did he do in the Marine Corps?
So he was I should have this memorized by now, but I don't know. He was in the air wing, and he recorded like the flights coming into the airport.
Got it.
But he hated that job. Because he is not a desk person. So he volunteered for search and rescue. And this is when he was stationed at Cherry Point. So we went down to the Naval Swim School in Florida and went through that training. And he got paid like flight pay and hazard pay, but he didn't get paid anything else other than that. But that job took priority over his desk job. So there was only two swimmers when he went through. And so after he went through, there was only three swimmers for, I think, about 3 years before they could get another swimmer through that school. And they were always, the three of them, always on call. None of them were allowed to leave the base in that 3 years. So if we wanted to see Jesse, we had to go out to his house.
All right, so talk to us. So tell us about Jesse. How, what kind of guy is he? He's your twin. You know, for like you're saying, like, yeah, well, it's not. We weren't identical twins. We just do everything at the same time. That's like, that's kind of twin like. I'm not saying, I'm just saying. So talk to us about, talk to us about Jesse. He gets out of the Marine Corps. I mean, obviously, if he's in the Marine Corps at that point, you know, during those years, he's deploying back and forth to, did he go to Iraq? Did he go to Afghanistan?
Yes. He went to Iraq at least once and Afghanistan at least twice, but I don't know where the fourth place was that he went.
Okay.
I don't know if it was Afghanistan or Iraq. Okay. So, but he deployed four times. And he was stationed at Cherry Point. When he was a search and rescue swimmer, he was non-deployable, and none of them were. And they all eventually, as soon as they got that fourth rescue swimmer and they got more guys going through, then they all eventually left search and rescue so that they could go to a duty station where they became deployable. And then they started deploying because you can't get promoted unless you deploy. And so they all had to leave in order to further their career.
We like having their work. We like having Marine experts on, Patricia, and you speak the language. He's deployable, can't get promoted unless you deploy. I like that. I like that. So your brother deploys, and then when does he get out?
He got out in 2014. The reason why he got out is because it was a couple years before, I believe in 2012. I'm not exactly sure, that him and his wife divorced.
Okay.
And so they have two kids together, and he got out as soon as he could, because he didn't want to miss any more birthdays. He's very dedicated to his children. So she moved back to Utah with the kids. And by the time he got out of the Marine Corps, she had already remarried, and she married an airman, and he was stationed in Idaho. And so he moved up to northern Utah, and he was about a couple hours from his kids.
Okay.
And then he got stationed in Illinois, so he moved to St. Louis, again, just a couple hours. And then they moved to Las Vegas, and except for he spent about 6 months in the hospital in Wyoming. And then after he got out of the hospital, he lived in Wyoming for several months before he finally made the official move to Vegas. But the kids were living in Vegas, and so he eventually moved down there. And him moving to Utah was the strangest thing that he had ever done when he did last March, because it was the first time he had ever moved away from his kids. So I still don't know why.
Yeah, why? So you don't have an explanation why he did that? Why he was doing that?
Well, I know that his girlfriend at the time was wanting to be closer to her work. But I think that there was a lot of, fighting between them at that time. And I think there was just so much guilt, and he just felt bad about it. And he was going through a lot of things with his, he had been in the hospital, like I said, and he had medicine that he was taking and therapy that he was doing. And when he moved to Vegas,
was he in the hospital for physical illness? Mental health?
So, yeah, he had been, it was up in Sheridan, Wyoming. He had been accidentally prescribed Xanax by a doctor.
Right.
And it made him turn into somebody that he was not himself. And so then he got taken to the hospital. Some people convinced him to go into the hospital, and it was kind of a detox thing where they got him off of the Xanax, and they got him, like, he was at a lockdown point or a lockdown part at one point, and then he went to group therapy and everything like that. And so he was with just a bunch of veterans going through the same kind of PTSD therapy and getting medicines worked out and everything like that.
Okay, and so that's when he's in Wyoming?
Yeah, that was in Sheridan, Wyoming. He and two other guys that he was in the hospital with moved down to Rock Springs, and they thought that they were going to become truck drivers afterwards. And I don't know really what happened with it. One guy decided to move to Oregon, and I'm in touch with him. And then the other guy, when Jesse decided, you know what, I got to go to Vegas. I can't be so far away from my kids. And so him and his girlfriend moved down to Vegas, and the third guy that was with him moved to California, where he's from, moved back to where his family was, and then he took his life about a month after moving to California.
Okay. Talk to us about your brother comes. So he's coming back to Salt Lake City. Take us to the point where he goes missing. What happens to set that chain of events in motion?
So I think that Jesse not being on his meds is the number one issue. he stopped taking his meds. And I think that that's probably the hardest thing about moving is setting up your health network again and finding the people that you trust. And I imagine that it's even harder for veterans than it is for civilians to find your trusted physician. And so having your therapy put in place and your doctor and, you know, having to put everything back in place, especially if you miss several doses of your medicine, is very hard. And when you're moving, you sometimes just miss stuff and things get put off that shouldn't be put off. And so I think that that's the biggest thing that happened, is Jesse did not have his network set up. And Jesse also, you know, thinks that I think that the stress of leaving his kids was a lot more than he realized, than he thought he could handle. And then also him and his girlfriend were fighting quite a bit, and they were having legal issues. She was trying to have a protective order against him, or to file for a protective order against him. And he had a lawyer. He didn't want the protective order to go through because he was trying to get into a security school for veterans in California and be able to become some kind of a security person. And you have to have a firearm for that job. And if there was a protective order on him, then he would have not been able to apply for that job or go through that school.
Right.
So it was a big deal to his livelihood. But also, I feel like there was a lot of weird, from what our friends say, Jesse and this ex brought out the worst in each other. And so I'm not saying that Jesse's innocent, but I know that he wasn't. The protective order wasn't for anything that he had done physically. Like, he hadn't physically hurt her. I know that he said really horrible stuff to her, like very, very emotionally abusive things, but he didn't physically touch her, and she didn't have I've read all the court paperwork. I've read all of his responses. I've got all of that stuff, and she doesn't have any. She's just claiming that he says these horrible things, but they were horrible things and they were threatening. But then ultimately what happened is, and I didn't know this until after it happened, but he had a warrant put out on him, because what happened is she had been calling the cops every time they were fighting. She called the cops, and one final time she called the cops, and a whole bunch of cops showed up, and they just said, Jesse, you need to come and talk to us. And he said, no, I'm exercising my Fifth Amendment rights. And so he didn't talk to them, and they weren't allowed to go in because he hadn't broken the law. And that's what every time she called the cops, that's what happened, is he never got arrested for hurting her. They just said, you know, sleep in separate bedrooms or whatever, and they would kind of settle it civilly with the police, or the police officer would settle it. But this last time, there was a whole bunch of cops there, and so he said, I'm not coming out. And so he didn't talk to them except to tell them that. And then they said, oh, well, you shouldn't stay here tonight, to his girlfriend. And she said, no, I have work in the morning. I'm going to stay in. I don't think he'll hurt me. And his son was there visiting and everything. And she said, I don't think he'll hurt me. And so they let her go back in. And then they gave her the information for a victim's advocate. And so she got a free lawyer, and she was able to file this protective order. The reason why the warrant was issued is because he was – that night, he hid her work computer. She works from home. He hid it on a high shelf, and she couldn't see it. And the next morning, when she asked about it, she had a meeting, and he said, "You don't get to work today because you called the cops for no reason." And he said this to the police. So that's an exact quote. That's what he told them. And it's on a recording and everything. And so that is called retaliation against a victim or a witness. And it is a felony crime. So, you're not allowed to punish someone for calling the police on you. But he did. So he punished her that way, and she lost about $1,600. She makes quite a bit of money. So that's another thing that really upsets me about the whole thing, is because it's not like she works, you know, she travels for work, and she is always in and out of the apartment. It's not like, I mean, she stays in hotels, she travels all around the country. She could have easily just taken her computer and left and gone to a hotel and been perfectly safe. She has plenty of money. She's not like, he's not, you know, in control of all the money. She makes more money than him, type thing. So she had full control, but when he hit her computer, she lost about $1,600 at that. And she was able to show, you know, her tax returns and pay stubs, and she lost about $1,600 in commission for missing that meeting when he hit the computer. So it is a lot of money, but at the same time, it's not like she was so broke that she had nowhere to go. The police told her, "You come with us, we'll put you somewhere, we'll take care of you." And she said, "No, I'm fine. I'm just going to stay here tonight." And she could have gone into a hotel. She could have gone to any friends, you know. And so it's just frustrating, but I think that the court would have seen that and been like, I think that he probably would have gotten probation for doing something like that. I don't think they would have actually sent him to jail for hiding a computer. But I think that at that time where he's not on his medicine, I think that he kind of built it up in his mind as to being worse than it was. And with the fact that he wasn't living in the same state as his kids, he was now kicked out of his apartment. And then he also did not have his phone. His ex-girlfriend had his phone. And so he did not have access to his bank accounts or to his email or to any of his social media. And she had access to all of that. So he kind of just lost everything. So he was friends with this woman, Natasha Harwell, in Scottsdale, and they had been friends for a long time and dated on and off. And so over the summer, they started dating again. And so he went to Scottsdale several times. And one of the times that he got to Scottsdale, it's when he found out that he had this, or he was going to have this warrant come out. And it came out in September. I don't know how he knew. And I can't talk to his lawyer, or his lawyer can't talk to me. So we would ask, does he have a warrant out? Like, because everyone kept talking about this warrant. And I said, does he have a warrant out for his arrest? And everyone would look at it and look him up and say, no, there's no warrant. But suddenly in October, ABC News is calling me and telling me that a warrant came out in September, and it was this felony warrant. And I was like, what? I said, I've been trying to find out about this thing this whole time, and I don't know why it took so long for it to go through. But the protective order was also put in place. So he's got this protective order against him, and he's got this warrant. And I think that he might have just been overwhelmed. And when I don't know, I don't understand PTSD or the stress that he's going through, but there's been times where I've felt overwhelmed, and it's usually because hungry or tired. And then as soon as I eat or sleep, suddenly I can look at these problems and I can figure out solutions. And so I think it's like that maybe 100 times fold or 100 times worse when you don't have your medicine and you just, everything comes crashing down suddenly and you don't know how to think your way out of it. And you just, it's just these glaring, loud, in your face problems. And I think that that's why he left. And I think he left and he went to commit suicide. And now when his car was found on the San Carlos Reservation, it confirmed it in my heart even more that he had.
Why did it confirm? Because there's been no body found. So one of the stories I read said that he could be in Mexico. Why do you think that he was going to kill himself?
He had been suicidal at other times. He had incidences where he was suicidal, and he talked about being suicidal. He would write letters to his kids and write letters to us, the rest of his family. He had had several incidences where he had wanted to commit suicide. And so in my mind, it was the culmination of everything, and he was going to take his life because he, and the thing is, he knows the training. He taught the training on Miramar, and he.
When you say the training, what training are you talking about?
The suicide prevention training. Wow. And so, and he also, you know, he was in that hospital. He had safety plans that he had written out or that others had written out for him with phone numbers. And it has like a column of triggers. And then it has a column of like things that make you happy. And in that column are his kids and his dog and looking at pictures of his kids or calling his kids if he can't see them physically or taking his dog out and going on a walk or working out. Those are things that make him happy, but he didn't do any of those things. He left the apartment. He left his phone and iPad at Natasha's apartment, and he left his service dog. He left his wallet. He left all his money.
Did he have a gun?
He did have a gun. Okay. He had a gun. He had a bottle of Xanax and a bottle of Tramadol.
Got it. Now he goes missing. You all obviously don't know where he is. And then in January, somebody, I read that a man from Michigan offered initially a $10,000 reward and then a $30,000 uh-huh. reward. So he goes missing. But you don't know at the time till his car's found in January, you know, where he's gone. So he could be anywhere. Talk to us about that, and then talk to us about the reward and whatnot.
So we thought initially that he had headed towards Las Vegas or up north towards Utah. Or down south to Mexico. He had been in Mexico 10 days before he went missing. Just a weekend bed and breakfast thing with Natasha, his girlfriend. And that's when he bought the Tramadol and Xanax. And his girlfriend didn't know that Xanax was bad for him. Or how bad it was for him. She just thought that he'd, you know, she just was like, oh, you're gonna be in bed for a week if you keep taking the Xanax like that. And he had said to her, there's not enough Xanax in the world to deal with this pain or to help me deal with the pain that I'm feeling. And he just was popping it like candy, and he was in bed for 2 days, and then he got up and he left. And until several weeks after Jesse went missing, I didn't get down there. My dad had already been down there, but then he came home and we turned around and went back the very next day. And then he and I, my dad and I, walked to all the businesses surrounding the apartment complex to find his car from the last time that he texted someone, which was at about 3 o'clock or 3:15, to the time that Natasha got home from work, which was 5:30. Me and my dad went and looked at all these video cameras, and we finally found one, but we were never able to confirm the license plate. It was just a car that looked exactly like his, the same make and model and color, but also it didn't have tinted windows. And in Phoenix, in Scottsdale, everything has tinted windows. And he was headed east, but there's a big freeway on-ramp right there. So we thought he had gone north, or gone north and then headed west, and then or gone south. We didn't think that he just went east. And San Carlos Indian Reservation is in eastern Arizona, about 2.5 hours east of Scottsdale. And so I was thinking that maybe he had gone to Mexico because he wanted to be able to have access to the drugs, the Xanax, get more Xanax when he ran out of the Xanax. Or I thought maybe he went to Las Vegas to be near his kids. I did think that maybe he just went camping, but he can only, I don't think he can, he's a very social person. He doesn't like to be alone. And so I don't think he would have been camping for more than a week. And so after about a week, I was like, okay, he's not camping. But he's an avid outdoorsman. He loves camping. He loves being outside and doing, you know, hiking and fishing and hunting. He loves all that. And so, but after a week, I was just like, no, that's not what's going on here. And so then for me, it was a race against, we got to hurry and find him before he kills himself. And I had done a lot of reading. I had found that there was a lot of veterans who go missing and they'll drive states away to get to some place that has meaning to them. And so our grandparents had a house in the Redwoods when we were little. And so I asked my cousin to live in the Sacramento area if they would go out there, because it was on the coast. It's kind of hard to get to. I was like, please go out there and see if Jesse's out there. And so they went out and searched all around on all our old hikes and searched around the old house and on the beach and everything for him. And they couldn't find anything that indicated that he had been out there. They had printed posters, everything. And then Lake Powell is a place that has a lot of, he loves Lake Powell. It's his favorite place on earth. And so I thought maybe he had been in Lake Powell and we started putting up posters there. And then he had a friend talk about Lee's Ferry. And so we had people going in there, putting up posters, looking for him there.
Where is Lee's Ferry?
It's just outside of Page, Arizona, which is just south of the Utah-Arizona border. So it's right near.
You guys have been essentially running down leads and kind of matching them with any place you know that he might be, and going and putting up flyers and trying to raise awareness. Mm-hmm. Awareness. What? So his car is found in January. Tell me about that. Obviously, now you know you're gonna. Is there anything in the car that gave you any indication? Can you talk about where the car was found? Was that significant? And was there anything in the car that gave you any indication of you know, his mindset, where he might be headed?
Yeah. So the car was found on the reservation, right smack dab in the middle of the reservation. It's not he went, I don't know if he went to the reservation on purpose, but he had a big giant map book of Arizona, And that map book was in the car, and it was open to the San Carlos reservation page.
Got it.
It didn't have any marks on it, anything to indicate anything. So, and no writing in the whole rest of the book, I've checked. Everything that he had in his car, I read. I read every single receipt. I read every single book. I looked through everything that was written in the margins or highlighted or underlined. I've read it. And the only thing, so Jesse's car was
okay, hold on. Let me ask, before you answer, as I'm listening to this, the thought just pops into my head, and I'm sure people are thinking the same thing. You have kids. You're from Utah. And uh-huh. So you left your kids in Utah, and now you've been to search for your brother.
So my son lives with his dad in San Diego.
Okay.
And my daughter lives with me in Utah. For the first 2 weeks, she was in Utah, and I went up for a week and kind of took a break, and then I came back down and I brought my daughter with me. So, my daughter doesn't really remember Jesse very well. When he lived in San Diego, he got stationed at Miramar while my husband was stationed at Pendleton. So we had a few close years there. It was the first time we had lived near each other or even in the same state for a really long time. My daughter doesn't really remember him, but she does know how stressful this search has been on me. And so she's been very attached to me. The first week, that week, a couple weeks ago when I went home, I was just in bed for the 3 days. I stayed in bed. I was asleep all day, and I was asleep all night, and asleep all day. And my daughter, she didn't go to school. And this was the week of President's Day week. And so she already had Monday off. But Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, she stayed with me. And then Friday is a half day. And so I was just like, you don't have to go in. And so then the following week we left, or that weekend we left and came here. And we've been here since. And so my daughter is with me. But yeah, for those first 2.5 weeks or so, I was here, and my daughter was staying with my parents.
Wow. Okay. Now, I interrupted you because I thought that was a significant footnote that people might be thinking about. So you go through everything in the car, and what do you conclude about? Was there anything there that gave you any indication where your brother might be headed, or what he might, was he headed to kill himself?
Yeah, to me, everything in the car shows that he went there to kill himself. He had fishing gear, he had a tackle box, he had a fillet knife, he had extra reels, he had a K-bar, he had gun cleaning tools, he had bullets, he had a jacket, he had two pairs of shoes, one was a running pair, one was a pair of hiking boots. He had a fishing net, he had a blanket, he had a hammock, one of those hammocks made out of really thin tent material that you can pack up real small. He had backpacks, he had bags, he had maps, he had tons and tons of bottles of water. All of this stuff that he had a shovel, he had all kinds of stuff that you could use to live out in the wilderness if you needed to, because he was an avid outdoorsman. He loved to be able to just stop on the side of the road and go camping if he wanted. And he loved exploring. He loved the Old West. He loved our, you know, the history, cowboys, Butch Cassidy. Another place that we went to is Butch Cassidy's home in Utah. He loved it all. And so he was always prepared for it. But nothing, the tank had less. It had an eighth of a tank of gas missing. So it was almost a full tank of gas in the car. The keys were in the ignition. All of this survival stuff was just spread throughout his car. His car's a mess, but it was all spread throughout his car. And I did post, I took everything. I laid out his blanket. It was full of burrs. I pulled all the burrs off of it, and then I categorized everything. He had deodorant, toothpaste, toothbrush, all this personal hygiene stuff. He had cash. He had everything that you could possibly need in the car. And I laid it all out, all his CDs, all of his cords for phones or for headphones or anything like that. He had batteries. He had just everything that he had. And I put it on Facebook so that people could see if there was anything missing or if there was anything that they didn't recognize. And there was just nothing to indicate anything about San Carlos except for that map book. He did have his expired passport in there. I didn't show that on Facebook, but I do have his expired passport. He had a railroad spike from a different railroad, not the one on San Carlos. And he had a lot of change, several loose dollar bills.
So what did all this tell you?
It told me that he drove to the end of the road. It was literally the end of the road. He went on some dirt road, and he was never getting out of there. He was never going to get that car back up that dirt road. And he drove down further and further and further until the very end. And then when he didn't reach the river, there was a river about a mile away. And that road didn't reach the river. I think he got out and he walked towards that river. And I think that he went to find a spot to sit down and take those pills. And if the pills weren't going to work, then he was going to shoot himself. And I think that he decided that he was going to do, he took very strong steps to make sure that he could never turn back. He couldn't get his car out of that road. He couldn't call anyone. He didn't have any money. He didn't, you know, he was not going to let himself be distracted from his goal.
All right. So that was his one-way ticket out that road. So now tell us what you're doing now. So now you're looking for your brother's body. So what are you doing now?
So I have not been able to look for his body. I have been out to the site of the car twice. Once with the rail workers who found the car, and then another time with the San Carlos Apache veterans who wanted to do an Apache prayer for him, for us. Me and Natasha were both there. And I did search around quite a bit. The issue is the car was found on tribal land.
Right.
They're a sovereign nation.
Right.
They have ultimate say. Graham County, San Carlos is in Graham County,
right,
and Gila County and Pinal County, and none of their search and rescue, none of their sheriffs are allowed to go in there and start looking for Jesse unless they are invited. And a lot of people might not realize this. I certainly didn't, but they are a sovereign nation. They are a completely different country.
So they won't allow you to look for your brother?
They have been saying that they are looking for him, and they have been, a lot of members of the tribe have tried to go out there. I haven't publicly announced where the vehicle was located, but a lot of people have asked me privately, and I still haven't told them. But it is a small nation, and they talk, and so it has gotten around among the natives where the car was, and apparently there have been a lot of people that have gone out there, but since they don't know exactly where the car was, I don't think any searches have been really very successful. Certainly not not in any kind of grid pattern or where they're going to make sure that everything is covered in the area. But San Carlos Fish and Game are the people that are in charge of searching, and the more I talk to them, the more it just keeps coming back to, they're looking for campfires, they're looking for food wrappers, they're looking for his favorite drink. They asked me, what's his favorite drink? And I said, White Monster. And they said, why would he be drinking White Monster out there? If he's going to survive out there, he would need water. He would need to get to these springs that are over here. Do you think he knew about these springs over here? And I said, no. Why would he need those springs? He's got about 18 bottles of water in his car. And you didn't ask me what I thought he was drinking. You asked me what his favorite drink was. He's got water in his car. He didn't take it with him because he's not trying to survive out there. He left the keys in the ignition. He got out of the car and he walked towards that water, towards that river. That's what I think. He walked towards that river and he went to find a place to sit down and take his life. And now, because it's the desert, because the desert, as I've been told several times since being here, the desert will swallow you whole. He has probably been taken apart by animals. If the gun has been found by anyone, guns are worth a lot on the reservation, worth more than the few $100 that it costs to buy them. If anyone came across the gun and they picked it up not knowing what it was and, oh, here's a great handgun, then they could have taken it. And then Jesse's clothing, we don't really have an idea of what he was wearing, except that he took his deck shoes from Natasha's apartment. That's the only pair of shoes that she doesn't have. And he had these boots and these running shoes in his car. He didn't wear those, so he must still be wearing those deck shoes. And walking around in the desert in deck shoes is not conducive to getting anywhere very fast or very far.
No.
So
you would destroy the shoes within, again, depending on the terrain, but you would destroy the shoes pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So now, how do you spend your days? This has been, and again, my guest is Patricia Conger. She's the twin sister of Jesse Conger, who's missing. And so how do you spend your days? I mean, if you're not allowed access to the reservation, Patricia, what do you do?
So I have made flyers and I've been going and speaking to people. There's been a lot of Native members of the tribe who have reached out to me personally, and I go and meet them or I speak with them, just talk to them through email or text or however they contact me. A lot of people want to have Jesse found, but I'm just still trying to get in contact with the right people, with the people on the council. I contacted Bureau of Indian Affairs to see if they could help. I've contacted the Apache Attorney General. He told me that they were going to call in Graham County Sheriff, who I've talked to Graham County Sheriff several times. He said that as soon as he found out that Jesse's car was found out there, he called San Carlos and said, I'm ready. As soon as you want us to come out, we're ready to come. We want to find this guy. We want to search for him. And they said, no, we're okay. We don't need your help. And so they've had, a couple of weeks ago, another reservation had a police officer was shot and killed, and his funeral was this past weekend. So a lot of people went up there to that funeral, to the White Mountain Apache funeral or reservation for that funeral. And so there's also a large hunt. There is also a large conference in Reno. And so the San Carlos Apache Police Department is no longer in charge of it. They set their Fish and Game Department in charge of it, but the Fish and Game Department has been so tied up with other things, yet they're not wanting to call Graham County Sheriff or any other sheriffs, any of the three counties that encompass this reservation. They haven't called any of them to have them come out and help. And when I talk to them, when I talk to the director, he says, we don't need their help. And he tells me, you know, he showed me maps. He showed me the places that they've searched, and that they're going to go out again. But I don't know how they're searching. I don't, everything that they say indicates to me that they are looking for a guy who's alive. So I have been taking flyers out to everyone. There's two little towns outside of the reservation called Globe in Miami, Arizona, and then there's also on the reservation, and I have these flyers. I keep printing them up, about 100 at a time, and I pass them out to everyone I can, and I just talk to everyone that I can, and it's just a big networking gig, and I'm not a networker, but I'll talk to anyone, and I've told his story about 10,000 times, and I try to just connect with people and try to let them know that people think that he's alive. Everyone around here thinks he's alive until they talk to me and I explain to them, these are the reasons why I think that his body is out there. These are the reasons why I think we need to look for him out here before we start saying, oh, he jumped on the train. Oh, he went to this town. Oh, he's living with someone on the reservation. Oh, he's, you know, here and here and here. We need to start at the new ground zero, which the new ground zero is where the car was found. And so when people are looking for a live person, but he's dead, they're not going to find him. And I want to do a search to find his remains before I start, you know, going to New Mexico to see if he hopped a train to New Mexico. You know, I think there's a process of elimination here, and the process starts at the car. So I'm just trying to gain access, gain permission, let people know that I'm not here to try and threaten their traditions or their customs or their way of life or take anything from them or disturb their land or to hurt them in any way. I just want to find my brother.
How can people that are listening, how can they help? Would it help to email the reservation? Would it help to, I mean, what can people do to help?
I guess, I don't really know. That's the thing that's so hard about it. If anyone has any, I don't know, some diplomacy, because clearly I don't have it. some ability to get them to want to let us. I mean, I would have been gone a long time ago. I've talked to people who know the reservation really well. I've talked to people who know what kind of terrain it is, and I've been told 20 people can clear this area within 3 days. And I just thought, for the amount of time that I've been here, I could have cleared that whole area by myself if I could have just been allowed out there. And so I don't really know. There's so many people that are trying to make calls, I don't have any email addresses, but trying to make calls, trying to make contact with me or for me. And so now I'm speaking with this woman today. I met this woman who is running for Arizona House, and she lives in Globe, and she said, okay, we're going to make this big search campaign, and we're going to everyone in Globe in Miami and on the reservation needs to know. And I feel like everyone on the reservation does know. There's not a single person that I talk to when I'm out there that doesn't recognize my brother and doesn't know what's going on when I hand them the flyers. But she's saying we need to let everyone on the reservation, all the natives, know that they need to talk to their council, their tribal council, and have him found. And it's been my experience. Everyone that I've spoken to, everyone that's reached out to me that is a native, they want him found. They care so much about this. They care so much that he is found.
Well,
and that
I know, I hear you saying that, but then why not let people help you search the reservation? I get all that. Everybody really wants them found, but nobody will open up the reservation and say, yeah, you know, here,
yeah.
Why just coordinate with us where you're going. So if we don't want you in certain places, we can tell you. So, I mean, yeah. that to me, I mean, sounds a little bit frustrating to me.
It is frustrating. There's only a few players that are really putting their foot down and saying, no, you can't. No, we will do the search. We're going to be here doing the search, and we don't need your help. We don't need anyone else's help. We can do it ourselves. One thing that was explained to me is if they have archaeological sites, they don't mark them off because they don't want people going in and stealing them. And so they have, someone did say to me, you know, this is a place where it's not blocked off, that it's sacred, because they don't want you to know that there's something in there that's sacred. They're not going to point it out and say, hey, look at me, come and steal this. But that's one reason I was given, is that there's things in there that are sacred. But then I hear things like, this is the place to go. This reservation has the largest elk in the world. And you go into their fish and game office and everything is, I mean, their elk heads are humongous. And so they have all these hunters come out. And even this coming up weekend, they have a predator hunt where you go out and you search or you hunt for bobcats and coyotes and everything like that. And so they allow hunting, they allow hiking, they allow camping. But for some reason, they're not allowing the search, and I just don't know what it is. And it's just, and people will say it's just the way the reservation works, and it's something that's so foreign to me. I just don't understand. And honestly, I think it's just that I offended the wrong person at some point.
Well, that'll do it. I know from living in North Dakota, where there's a whole number of reservations out there. I mean, if you do offend them, then the answer is going to be no, and they don't need to, as you said, they're a sovereign nation. They don't need to give you an answer. It just seems to be very frustrating. How do people help? What can they do? What can anybody do to help? To help you, Patricia?
So the City of Globe and the City of Miami, they are trying. So tonight I am going to their city council meeting. They're holding an emergency meeting.
Globe, Arizona and Miami, Arizona?
Yeah.
Okay.
And since they work with the tribal council members so closely, I'm hoping that if I can talk to them and tell them my story, that they will speak to the tribal council members individually and kind of get buy-in from the council. And also, I have a radio interview. Well, tomorrow is the monthly tribal council meeting. That starts at 9 a.m., and I'm supposed to go in at 9 a.m., but since I'm not on the agenda, I'm just going to be fit in wherever. So it's an all-day meeting. So I'm going to go to that. But the radio station and a couple of friends that I've made here are going to attend with me. And then after... I went in with this woman who's running for state rep, and she was talking to the newspaper here, and she said, can we get an ad? Can we have this be an ad in the newspaper? Can you print this in the newspaper? And the editor came out and said, oh, yes, but we already sent the paper for this week, so it'll be in next week, and it'll be in both papers. And she said, how much is that? And he said, it's no charge. Absolutely. We're going to do this. This is something we care about. We're so upset about this. And so a lot of people do know about it but I think just the more and more this state rep is saying, we're going to do this massive search. We're going to do this massive campaign, I guess, for this search. And so she's just saying, we're going to start handing out these. We went over to the printers. I had already bought about 250 flyers and passed them out, but she just got more. And she said, we need more. We need them to be free. Can you donate them? And they're like, yes, you can. And I was like, man, where were you 2 weeks ago?
It would seem to me If they would say yes, I mean, I can tell you, there'd be a whole lot of veterans that would show up to help look for your brother.
I have hundreds of people tell me
could,
every day.
And they could coordinate the efforts in terms of, as you said, checkerboarding, you know, and if his remains are out there, as you said, I mean, the desert's a cruel place. But, you know, the way people tend to be found is there's clothes. Right, there's shoes. Mm-hmm. There's things that we all, you know, have with us and carry with us. And you find one thing, and you say, "This is his." And you know you're in the area. And so now and that's happened before out in the desert. And so I don't know. It just seems like this is not that difficult to do. And I just don't honestly understand why they won't. But is there a way people can contact you if they want to help? Do you want to give anybody, or do you want them to contact me and I can forward it to you? How would you like to do that?
So my number is, if you Google Jesse Conger, my phone number comes up. This number that we are talking on right now, it's 619-871-7097. Or you can reach me on Facebook, Patricia Conger. You can reach me on Messenger.
And Jesse is J-E-S-S-E-E.
Just E.
Yes.
One E.
One E.
J-E-S-S-E.
Okay. Got it.
And so, and also hashtag find Jesse will bring it up. And so anyone can call me. A few months ago after I am going through a lot of anxiety myself. I know that this isn't like, you know, PTSD or shell shock or whatever. Like I've never had my life in danger, but
I don't really think that that's true though. I think trauma is trauma, and it doesn't matter if it's your life's in danger or if on a daily basis you get up and go look for the remains of your brother. I think it scars us all the same way, and I don't think that how you get there matters. So I'm not saying, but I'm a little bit of kind of an expert on PTSD, and I would tell you that welcome to the club.
Yeah. But, well, in any case, I don't sleep unless I take a sleeping pill at night. And so I won't answer your call if I'm asleep anymore because I am knocked out. But I used to say, call me anytime, day or night, and I'll answer. And that kind of landed me in the hospital for a bit because I was just too stressed out. But still, call me, leave a message anytime, day or night, and I will get it the next morning. anyone who has any ideas, anyone who's knows anyone who has, I mean, I have said over and over, what does the tribe want? Like, I will do whatever they want. It doesn't have to be. If they need something, I will. Like if they want solar on their whole tribe, I'll give them solar. I will give them, you know, thousands of dollars worth of solar. I will draw up their plans. I will plan it out. They will have free electricity for the rest of their lives. If that's something that anything that I can give them, I will give them if they let me search. And I just need to search. And I know, and my dad keeps saying to me, you know, we may never find him, even if you do go out there. And so I do know that we may never find him. Even if he is out there, we may never find him. Or if he's not out there, of course we won't find him. But I still have to look. It's the only thing that I have to look for him with. It's the only thing that's substantial that can give me something to look for. And so I have to look, and I don't want to be the one to look. I don't want to be the one to find his remains, and I don't want his friends to be the ones to find his remains. But if that's what it takes, I will do it. And so...
Okay, can I give you some advice?
Yeah.
And I hesitate to do this live on the air, but I know there's a lot of people. This radio show is about post-traumatic mental health. That's what All Marine Radio is, right? And that's, and you know, I mean, from our conversation, you have to take care of you, okay? You have to take care of you. Whatever's happened to your brother has happened to him. And your family doesn't need to lose two people. Your children can't lose their mother. And so I know we can all feel your commitment to your brother, okay? But you've got to take care of you. And at some point, right, I think you're going to have to face the day that when you're going to, and I know it's unpleasant, that you're going to have to say, you know what, we may never find him. And because your children need you, your life has to go on, and you have to live a life. And you have to live a life. And so I just want to tell you that. And I can't tell you how much I respect your commitment to your brother. And I think everybody that listens to this interview can hear it coming through every word that you say. Right? But you've got to live your life. And so be mindful of that and be really careful.
I will. I know. There's...
Because you're part of our family, man. You got Marine oozing all out of you. And honestly... Patricia, you know, you can be there for other people that have to go through the same experience. And by helping them, I think you honor your brother's life. And there's a whole lot of ways that you can add meaning to your brother's life. And so I just want you to know from your tribe, which is us, right, that we love you and we care about you and we so respect what you're doing. But at the same time, right? We don't want to lose you too. So be careful and be mindful of that. And there's absolutely not one bit of dishonor in saying, you know what? I've been out here for long enough. I've done enough. I've done everything that you've gone beyond everything that a reasonable person would do. And so, just be mindful of yourself and of your children, how much they need you and that we need you too. And there's a whole lot of ways that you can make Jesse's life count for something, and that is by touching the lives of other people with what you've been through, people that are going to go through the same thing in the future, and that you can help them and you can be there for them. So be careful there.
I absolutely, one thing about this town, this teeny tiny town of Globe, Arizona, is they have jumped to every possible physical need that I've needed. They've given it to me. This town has been amazing. And even people on the reservation, you know, they say, I don't have much, but if you need a sofa to sleep on, you can come to my house. And, you know, there's so many people in this whole state. There's so many people since this search began that have shown so much love and compassion. And so I am being very well taken care of physically. And I do know what you mean. I do know that there is going to come a time where I am either going to find him or I am going to run into that brick wall and it's going to break
my nose.
Wait
a minute. You said come a time? Patricia, you might already be there. When you go home and you sleep for 3 days and you don't get out of the bed, right? And you can't sleep. You know, when I do this thing I do called post-traumatic winning, there's this thing I call faking it. And this is what faking it sounds like, right? I'm all right, but I can't sleep at night. I'm all right, but I feel alone. I'm all right, but I get really nervous when I'm in a crowd. Well, guess what that means? I'm not all right. Okay.
Okay. I get what you're saying. I am sleeping at night, but it is
all right. Just
of the
so
medicine.
You know, if I have to come to Arizona and take you back to Utah and say, "Hey, enough is enough. We all respect you. We love you. You're part of our tribe." And in a moment's notice, we can go back there if somebody finds something. But you have a life to live too. You have solar people that need your help. You have women who want to consult with you about now putting up solar panels. And you've got a right to live your life too. And I just, again, we don't need to lose two people, you know, after we've lost one. So I just want you to promise me that you'll do that. And if I find out that you're running yourself ragged, I'll come to Arizona. Yeah. No, hey, and that's straight up no shit too. Cause your brother was one of my brothers. And we owe that to him to make sure that not only we try to help you, but we try to help you in a lot of different ways. And part of that might be saying, Jesse, all right, hey, we're going to talk to your sister. And just so you know, from us into the sky and to the great beyond where you are, all right, we're going to tell Patricia it's time for her to go home, right? We love you, brother, but this is the right thing to do. So you be really careful, because I'm not afraid to come over in my Nissan Frontier and come looking for you in Globe, Arizona, and make sure you do the right thing, okay?
Okay. I promise.
There you go. All right. Patricia, first of all, anything that we can do to help, you have my phone number. All you got to do is yell, and I would be, you know, more than happy, and I speak for a lot of people. We would be more than happy to help. So let us know, and want to wish you all the best of luck in your meetings coming up here, and be safe. And I have that promise on digital audio, just for the record. All right.
Okay. I really appreciate everything, Mac. Thank you.
All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.